You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Good morning, folks, and welcome to another 3CR Gardening Show. I got the thumbs up from Matt and Di. We are going to air, so that's we're on. Thanks for listening in folks, to the 3CR Gardening Show. My name's John Arnott, and joined in the 3CR studio this morning by three terrific panellists, all with a common thread associated with urban horticulture, produce, productive gardens, orcharding and fruit trees. What I'm just wondering what the collective noun for an orchardist is. Maybe it's a core or a pip or a pulp. I'm not sure. This morning I'm joined by Karen Sutherland from Edible Eden Design. Karen is an author, a garden designer, an educator, and a passionate food grower. G'day, Karen.
Hi, John. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
And also a long-time apprentice of yours.
Yeah, we go back a little while.
We do go back.
Mid-1980s, I believe.
Yeah, it's somewhere a long time ago.
Yeah. Also joined by Craig Castry, horticulturist, educator again, and author of Edible Gardens, amongst a few other publications. Thanks, Craig, for coming into the studio.
G'day, John. How are you going?
Good, mate. You might just want to... Can you just square that up?
That's much better, mate.
And last but certainly not least, today, very pleased to welcome Graham Morrison to the studio. Orchardist, horticultural educator. Now, there's some common ground happening here. Horticulturist educator, lifelong advocate for home food growing. G'day, Graham.
Thanks, John. I think just saying we're pretty honoured to have the past manager of the Royal Botanical Gardens down at Cranbourne. I bow to you.
No, not at all.
The current
manager of horticulture at the Cranbourne Garden goes a ride as well. He's a friend to the 3CR Garden Show. It's Tex Moon. So the gardens are in very, very good hands. Matt, Di, thanks for coming in and producing this morning show, getting us to air week in and week out. Graham, a couple of weeks ago we celebrated the 50th anniversary of 3CR.
Yes,
we did a retrospective, which was a lot of fun. And yes, going back through the archive prior to the show, I saw references to Graham Morrison with the 3CR Garden Show that go back 20 years.
Yeah.
How long have you been involved with the show, and how did you come to be involved with the gardening show?
So I was trying to work that out the other day. It could be close to the 30 years, I think. You
it's
know.
30 years, yeah.
Yeah, probably about 25. But Pam Vardy was the, head of the show at that stage of the game, and got on very well with her. She was just over in Eltham, where I'm in Doncaster, sort of thing. So, early days. I worked in the orchard. I mean, it was too early to tell my brief story.
Yeah, please.
I was born in an orchard. My two sets of grandparents were orchardists, and Dad was an orchardist, Mum was an orchardist, and of course, those days, you grew up in an orchard and you learned such a lot, out there in the orchard.
And this is in Doncaster.
Yeah, in Doncaster.
Yeah.
Saw the writing on the wall, so I went back and I always wished I'd perhaps followed the education a bit more, so I think. Did 3 years of night school, going to La Trobe University, and then got a job up at Hawkesbury Agricultural College as a lecturer and looking after projects of the students up there.
Okay.
And then one of my jobs up there was to liaise with Swain's Nursery, and they made quite a few donations to our college, Hawkesbury Agricultural College. And I thought to myself, you know, it's not such a bad thing to be in nursery. Why don't I have a go? So we still had a little bit of land back home in Doncaster, and my good brother Don, who was in partnership all just 14 months difference to me. The siblings don't always get on, but we did all got on as well, sort of thing. I asked him, and he always thought about it for a while, but why don't we have a go at having a retail nursery in Doncaster? So, yeah. It was 32 years ago, 14 years ago, I retired, so there you go.
There you go. And that was Morrison's nursery in Doncaster.
Yes, that's true, sure. Yeah.
We were just chatting with Craig earlier. Yeah. You've got a connection.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I started out in a wholesale nursery.
Yeah.
And I used to do a Doncaster run, and it would take me all day to drop off all the nurseries along the way from Tullamarine all the way. And we used to wind up somewhere around about Yarra Glen Nursery, I think, was about the last on that run. But there was Warrandyte Fern Nursery, and there was all those. And, of course, Morrison's was one of the others that we would drop off to. So, and remarkable how many nurseries we've actually lost run. I mean, you could probably only stop by about two or three now.
Well, every other block in the Dandenongs back in the day was a nursery. Yeah, field nursery.
So much so.
Yeah. True. And you were mentioning a variety of a plum or...?
No. Well, of course, I'm involved with the Werribee Park Heritage Orchard.
Yeah.
And Graham's descendants have peaches. Morrison and Arch Morrison, who's Graham's father. We have those both peaches in the orchard, in the ground, and we are today still selling Scion material. And I just grafted some not so long ago to keep them in circulation, yeah.
My brother Craig, after we retired, that's my younger brother, 10 years younger than me, and he was like you were saying he liked peaches, so some of the old varieties, like about 30 varieties, he actually maintained and grew them in his backyard.
Well, that's fantastic.
Good to keep those old varieties. When you just come to breeding sort of thing, they can be very handy to get what you're looking for.
Yeah, I think from memory we have just under 90 varieties of peach in the orchard.
Anzac, and there were all of those varieties.
We've got some fantastic varieties down there.
Well, my grandfather, he started Millicent.
We also have Millicent.
That's right.
Named after his daughter.
I've got those listed in my book, book. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Come full circle.
Well, I mean, and that's really what the Heritage Orchard mob are about. They're about holding on to those old cultivars, keeping them going, because we must have lost a lot over the
years. Sadly, our fruit is not grown for us these days, and I think that's one of the big things that supermarkets have pushed away so many non-commercial varieties, or what they consider non-commercial, because they have thin skins, they don't ripen all at once, they're a bit misshapen, et cetera, they don't travel well, they don't they get some blemishes.
They don't meet the criteria.
That's the problem. I mean, they're about keepability on the shelves, and we're about flavour.
Mm.
And, if you grow peaches the correct way, I mean, you're not sending them to a supermarket because they're going to be mushed by the time they get there.
Yeah.
And so they should be, you want them to be dripping down your face when you bite into them, and that's how our peaches are. And
and
they're like that today. They're much bigger than tennis balls.
Yeah.
And you just can't get that sort of quality of fruit in the orchard.
We had a variety called Wiggins.
We've got Wiggins as well.
And it was the best peach to eat in my... It was just a lovely, when Dad used to say you have to eat it over a bath because the juice runs everywhere.
I need more peach juice. I'm making a list here.
Yeah. It's remarkable.
It didn't have colour.
Yeah,
we'd pull all the leaves off the tree to try and get the sun in to get the colour going there. But, put them on the supermarket bench, they've got to have colour.
Did it matter that it didn't have colour? Didn't affect the taste at all?
No, not at all. The taste was similar with some of the strawberry varieties.
Yeah.
There's a lot better taste in some of the strawberries that have been discontinued. They go for the big glamorous, you know, apples too, plenty of red on the skin, and
yeah,
that sort of attracts the general buyer.
Yeah. So it does not meet the criteria. It doesn't look like a peach or an apricot should look like on the shelf.
Well, if you think about apples, 13,500 registered varieties globally. How many do you get to pick from?
13,500 varieties of apples.
13,500. It's been going a long time. I mean, one that people get romanced by, I think, is Cox's Orange Pippin.
Yep.
And it's a lovely apple, and I've got to say, but if you don't, it's got about a week of keepability.
Yeah, sure.
If you pick it early, you'll throw it in the bin, and if you pick it later than a week after it's ripened, you'll throw that in the bin too. You know, but that's been grafted since 1640. So someone like me and others have been cutting, you know, a piece of those original tree and passing it on, and we're still today, 2026, still grafting that
doing the same thing.
I was going to say, Craig, that's a bit like when Penny and I and Janice did the tomato book. I was thinking it's not just the flavour, it's the history.
I'm
listening to all this history and thinking, you know, that's what you're part of. You and Graham are both part of that history.
And look, I mean, and that's, I mean, I'm only a newcomer to this. I mean, I've been involved at the Orchard for 16 years, and but let me tell you, I mean, just recently, the Orange Research Station, Cherry Orchard, has been bulldozed. But we have been able to get a hold of all of those scions, and we've got 65 varieties of their peaches now in the ground.
How wonderful.
So we've saved those. And it's on a heritage-listed site, so like no one can come bulldoze Werribee Park. And that's, I guess, the importance of that site, because well, there's a lot of heritage orchards about, but they're not listed. They're privately owned, and if they get sold and they get redeboloped, you lose the trees.
Didn't know about Orange. So that's quite shocking.
That's sad.
When we got wind of it, we thought, hey, we put our hand up and said, listen, please send us the scion and we'll see if we can't get them. So we grafted them and put them into the ground, and you know, here we are, we're back in business.
They are secure.
Yes, absolutely, and rightly it'd be a shame to lose. And look, they've got some wonderful varieties.
Yes,
cherry country, isn't it? Oh, well, I mean, Tasmania is cherry country, but when you go up there, you see all these signs, cherries for sale.
Well, it's a cold climate. It's considered a cool climate.
But there's good cherries to be had.
And it's kind of, look, Werribee's not cool climate, but it is on that cusp.
Craig, comment on that? Will they?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, Chilliwack is the most important for fruit set, you know. So the beauty where we are, we're on the river flat, and if it even looks like a frost, we get one, which is kind of good because we then get all of those varieties that need a lot of high chill hours.
Yeah.
Our low chill don't do so well, but they're okay. I mean, we've got a couple of low chill varieties that, you know, hardly need any chill hours whatsoever.
How does that work, the low chill thing? Because the plants are dormant.
The thing is that the trees don't really truly go dormant here in Australia.
No.
Our ground doesn't freeze like it does where these are native too. So the trees are a bit bewildered to some degree. And they only need a set soil temperature and they're happy, you know. So and if they get X amount of hours, you know, around about that, they burst into flower. And they do it very early. We've got trees in flower now. You know,
Hasn't the season? But yeah, that was one thing. Been travelling and being up in New South Wales and seeing magnolia, Selangiana. Flower. And I know on the way here this morning they're flowering. Like they're not meant to flower till mid August or September.
And seeing things
like that, like they're kind of, you know, one of those canaries in the coal mine or markers, and like those years that we start to get fruit trees flowering again in late autumn because it hasn't been cold enough to send them into dormancy. And, there's all sorts of wacky things going on.
Of course, then there's the early, mid and late varieties. So, I mean, I've got one called the Christmas apple, and I will pick apples in December. Now, that's on a multi-grafted tree in my front yard. So that's a very, very early apple, let me tell you. And that tree is now currently dormant. It's got bud swell happening. It's got to set leaves, flower, pollinate and produce fruit between now and December. And yet on the same tree I've got Granny Smith, which won't be picked, but it will flower around about the same time, more or less.
Yeah.
and it won't get picked until June next year.
How about that? So when you talk about chill hours, it's the soil?
Soil temperature.
Soil temperature. Yeah, it's soil not the temperature of the air.
No.
Yeah, okay.
Soil temperature. So somewhere between 6 and 10 degrees.
Yeah.
So high chill, you know, you're looking at 800 or 900 hours.
Yeah, right.
So I've got a little bit of a trick with chill hours. If it's looking pretty warm winter,
yeah,
I drag bags of ice and spread it underneath the trees out of the chest freezer in the garage.
Graham, have you ever considered getting icing the root balls of your trees?
I was overseas somewhere, and there was this good lady, a keen gardener, giving us a talk about, and they were peony roses.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a herbaceous peony and a tree peony, isn't it, sort of thing. One of them has got to be fairly cold, and so she did that same thing, out with buckets of ice sort of thing around a tree. Got to be keen, haven't you?
It's wonderful, you know. I mean, some of these old timers that have been around a long time have passed on so much.
So much information.
And it's often, it doesn't get written down. And no. I mean, I've learnt so much from, there was an old timer orchard.
Like us.
Yes. that taught me a great heap of little tricks that have, you know, have really changed my experience with, you know, setting fruit on fruit trees.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Karen, you were very, very generous to offer a tour of your permaculture garden as a part of Radiothon. So thank you for that. I just wanted to thank you personally for that. So it sold like hotcakes.
Oh,
like
that's
nice. It went really, really quickly.
That's nice, yeah.
Yeah, so what, I mean, yeah, what should people expect?
I thought after I did that little spruik on the thing, blurb. I thought, gee, I really said nothing there. So I kind of slapped myself a bit. Well, I wasn't awake, I think.
The marketing didn't affect the result.
Well, probably because I've done lots of openings before for Open Gardens,
yeah, okay,
Australia, Victoria, and so it kind of was known, I suppose, and people enjoyed it.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
It's known for being an urban food, you know, growing your food in small spaces. It's not that small. It's about 600 square metres, or a bit under 600 square metres.
Okay, so it's a reasonable size block.
Yeah, but it's very packed in.
Yeah.
So I think that's what people liked. And actually, it's funny, I've never really thought about it till the other day. I thought funnily enough, the inspirations for packing it as much as possible, it wasn't scientific, or it wasn't necessarily, even though it kind of translates into a food forest with everything all layered in. Mm. But funnily enough, it was old Italian neighbour, because I watched him and thought, gee, look at all the stuff. And he, many, many multigraphs, and he's long since passed away. But I used to go down and look at his garden and think, oh, wow, look at this. And he's got these trees and they're just pruned really small. And so, yeah, inspiration from him. And weirdly, Constance Spry.
Okay.
Which you never heard him mentioned on 3CR probably, but I was buying all these books from op shops. And
Constance
Spry. She was a florist in the 30s or 40s or something. And anyway, she used to pack all her plants in, a bit like Jack Semler would. I bet Jack Semler's heard of Constance Spry.
Yeah, okay.
So packing in, and I thought, oh, that's a good method. I'll try and fit more plants in, you know. So, but then it progressed on, and then, you know, then you learn other things, and as you do in horticulture.
And food forest, because there's layers.
Because
that's the difference. That's
classify
it as a food forest.
Gradually I've taken out things that aren't, you know, because when you've only got limited space, in order, like in something in your life, you know, I read something the other day about if you want to bring in a new habit, you have to stop doing something else because you've got to fit it in.
Yep.
And so to fit another food plant in, I had to take out something that wasn't edible. So very reluctantly you'd take out one thing and put in another. And so gradually it's just been more and more and more packed.
Yep.
So, yeah, there's lots of various – and lots of self-seeding. I class that as a food forest thing because it's things that just happen themselves. And
Yeah,
it's just a lot easier. It's an easy way of growing, so I can show people, look, these have self-seeded, they're growing by themselves. The weeds, one interesting thing that's happened over many years is the weeds have become quite curated or diminished because it's so packed.
There's not much room for them.
So when you fit in all the good stuff, then you actually don't get many weeds, or you just get the ones you want. So,
of course, weeds are successional plants.
Yeah.
And they're there to repair soil. So inadvertently through diversity, you're actually shutting them out. Your plants that you're growing are taking over their role. They're doing the things that the weeds would otherwise do if they weren't, if you weren't doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
One of my catch cries is full gardens grow no weeds.
Or just a few tiny little bits that you need.
So, well done.
Good soil, built from garden waste. So I just brought it all home when I was a gardener and built it all up and...
Refresh my poor memory of permaculture. What is actually involved there?
Well, there's a lot of everyone has a different translation, but the basic translation is permanent agriculture, which of course in the city you're not agriculture, but you're growing food. So it's a system of growing food where. That's why I talk about the self-seeding because I don't do very much annual planting. So I've got a lot of things that I rely on that grow for long period annuals, things that might grow for 6 or 12 or 18 months, like land cress or and other greens like that, that you can always go out and harvest things and you don't have to continually be planting. So it is attractive to people that are busy. And, you know, it's quite a good system. And lots of things in the shade too. So that's inspirational for people because urban gardens have so much shade and you think, oh, I can't grow anything.
Well, you can.
But you can grow heaps of things.
And Craig, just, you know, while we were reflecting on Radiothon a couple of weeks ago, there was a fruit pruning and grafting masterclass that you held down at the...
Yes, it was good.
As for Radiothon. Any report back from that?
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, look, everyone loved what they did and saw and learned. So, there's just so much to learn. So, it was great.
Yeah, great.
Heaps and heaps of people. So, and a lot of people travelled a long way, which was remarkable. I vaguely remember someone came from New South Wales.
Oh, really? Yeah. There you go. So, you can pull the crowd, mate.
Unbelievable. So, no.
Give them a pruning knife, and they think they're a surgeon.
we actually didn't equip them with any of that because we're a bit of a stickler for... obviously spreading disease is a very easy thing to do. And
I thought you were going to say trying to avoid trips to the hospital.
Oh, well, that too.
People that are new to knives.
So, look, it was well received and everyone went away very happy, I'm sure.
Well, again, thank you so much for supporting the show. Craig, I make an association with Craig and T-shirts with a message of like written T-shirts. What do you got on today? You got No Dig Gardener. You must have drawers and drawers of horticultural
things.
It's
all about the message, I guess. Okay. And, because I do a lot of public speaking and a lot of workshops and so forth. So I try and, where appropriate, pick the right T-shirt for the right topic, But I've got about 40, I think. And if I'm moving to something new, then there's a new T-shirt.
Well, in terms of the 3CR Garden Show, I can announce that we've got some 3CR Garden Show merch, which is out and about, that you can pre-order now. So there's some Gardening Show merchandise, T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, all manner of 3CR Gardening Show merchandise. So if folks want to have a look at some of the 3CR merch, you can jump on the 3CR website and there's an online store where you can actually pre-purchase. So next time you come in, Craig, we're expecting it proudly and, you'll be a walking billboard for the 3CR Gardening Show.
I'll do that. Absolutely. Yeah. I actually had one from a radio station I was at yesterday.
So, oh, yeah? What were you doing yesterday?
I was at Southern FM.
Actually, could you just do a rundown of your week? Can you just do a rundown of your week? I reckon Craig Gill were one of the busiest people in horticulture at the moment.
Well, Friday I drove 8.5 hours to Forbes. On the Saturday morning I got up and did a stint at the community garden and then I did a soil masterclass Saturday afternoon that went 3.5 hours solid. And then attended a dinner in my honour along with the community garden that helped run this.
How lovely.
On the Sunday, I did two workshops, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, a quick trip out to Parks and then up to Orange and then back to Forbes, up first thing in the morning and drove back down to Melbourne.
Yep.
And then I had Tuesday, I had an online consultation for someone to do. Wednesday, I had a workshop at one of the local community centres. Friday, I was back at the orchard, so I grafted 100 and something odd trees on. And then Saturday, yesterday, was the radio station. This morning, I'm here. So, yeah, it's a, it's a busy, hectic week.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. And you're listening to the 3CR Garden Show this morning. The panel, this morning's panel, a wonderful panel exploring all things urban agriculture, orchards, fruit trees, productive gardens. So we're joined this morning by Karen Sutherland from Edible Eden Design, Craig Castry and Graham Morrison. If you'd like to speak with the panel, put a question to the panel this morning, we'd love to hear from you. You can call in on 9419 0155, and you could also put a text through to the panel this morning on 0488 809 855. Yeah, call in. We'd love to hear your questions this morning. There is a little bit. We're just going to jump into some community announcements. There's a little bit on in terms of community announcements. And the first one I have here this morning is Colour Your Garden with Australian Native Plants with Chloe Foster. Chloe is speaking at the Australian Plant Society Cardinia Group on the topic of keeping your garden looking colourful all year round using Australian Native Plants. We all know Chloe. We know how enthusiastic Chloe is about the Australian flora, and an opportunity to catch up with Chloe, support the APS. This particular event with Chloe is on Tuesday, the 11th of August, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. It's at the Deep Creek Reserve Eco Centre Function Room, which is Cameron Way, Pakenham, Victoria. Registrations are free, but you need to register on Humanitix. So jump onto Humanitix, pop in Colour Your Garden with Australian Native Plants, Chloe Foster, and that'll take you to the website. So, yeah, Chloe will be reflecting a little bit on some of the information in the Rookie Gardener. Strengthen and District Post-Fire Gardening Series is on at the moment, and this is in response to the serious wildfires that went through that country last summer. This is at the Strentham Memorial Hall, 8 Campbell Street, Strentham. And it's actually brought to you by the Lake Bolac Bush Nursing Centre and Ararat Council, who are supporting this this particular series. So on Tuesday, the 25th of August, from 6:30 to 8:30, there is a talk about by Digby Alston, and he's talking about landscape design for country gardens with an eye to sort of fire, you know, setting up a fire, a garden which is, you know, less likely to be involved with wildfire. It's fascinating. What's happening in front of me is Craig's actually doing some grafting. Well, we should try and capture some of this. The Orchid Societies of the Orchid Societies Council of Victoria have got an orchid show, which is on the 23rd of August, so in a couple of weeks' time. It's at the Boxhall Pavilion, KCC Park, Western Port Highway Sky. If you're interested in orchids, get out to the orchid show. It is a huge event. Registrations for that are $10, and it's a wonderful opportunity to experience the incredible diversity of orchids and learn how to grow them and speak with some really experienced growers. Craig, I'm going to throw to you, if I could, just about the Winter Heritage Fruit Tree Festival, which is next weekend, yeah?
Yes, it is. It's on the 9th of August. It starts at 10 a.m., finishes at 3 p.m. at the Werribee Park Heritage Orchard.
Yep.
Come down K Road, go down past Gate 2, it's signposted. It's a free event.
Okay.
So we have grafting demonstrations, tours, talks, presentations. There's a heap of allied vendors there as well, not the least of which myself and my good mate Vasily is along with others. So, but of course, the big thing is that it's our fundraiser event.
Yeah.
We're unfunded. We, you know, are preserving the fruit tree heritage for Victoria.
Yep.
So we need some support. And if you're looking for some rare and heritage fruit trees, we've become Australia's largest grafting day event. Nowhere can you go anywhere in Australia to have the amount of different varieties available in scion material on that one day than where we are. So, and of course, we've got ready grafted fruit trees, trees that you just cannot get, as you've heard today, you know, peaches like the Layla Morrisons and Arch Morrisons and Millicents and Anzacs and Croydons and Munro, and there's a whole host of them, Wiggins. You know, so we have them all, and it's just a wonderful event. So get along. It's a great family event. There's food and wine and there's some entertainment there as well.
Yeah, so, fantastic.
We do ask at $1 coin donation.
Gold but that's coin optional. Donation. I mean,
if we could.
So that's next weekend?
Next weekend, next Sunday.
Yep.
So be there. We'll make sure you come and say good day.
Yeah, terrific. Good on you. Good on you. And just back to the Radiothon, Sunday the 16th of August from 10:30 to 12:30, there's the Radiothon tour of the Dandenong Rangers Gardens, and there's still some spots available for that. So if you are interested in that one, it's joining Tex Moon from the show, Craig Wilson from the show, alongside the designer of the Chelsea Flower Show, Australian Garden, Phil Johnson. So a wonderful opportunity to get up into the hills, have a look at the Dandenong Rangers Botanic Gardens through the eyes of Tex and Philip, and then kick on to Craig Wilson's Gentiana Nursery. So that's Sunday the 16th of August, 10:30 to 12:30. Two of the Dandenong Rangers, all the funds from that actually go to the 3CR show as a part of Radiothon. So it's a bit of a Radiothon. It's a Radiothon event. If you're interested in that, you can actually go to the 3CR website and go to the online store and buy some tickets for that. Fascinating what's happening in front of us here. We're actually doing, Craig's doing some grafting. Maybe we should actually try and capture. What are you doing there, Craig?
So, well, I'm putting in what we call a modified approach graft. So people in small spaces should really look at espaliering fruit trees.
Yep.
And, of course, they buy a fruit tree and it's generally got a main stem and really only two lower branches that's going to produce the first two laterals that they'll tie on the frame. But what I show them how to do is to put some grafts where the wires are, where they want.
Yeah.
Different varieties, early, mid and late, so that they've got a heap of different varieties on their tree. Now, I've got five apple trees and I'm on a smaller block than you, Karen. I'm on 500 square metres, and of the blend that I can use, it's really only 120 square metres. But in five apple trees, I've got 36 varieties of apple.
In 120 square metres?
In 120 square metres.
There you go.
So I'm with you with making good bang for your buck. I mean, wherever I've got soil, I've got something that I can put on the plate, whether it's be fruit or vegetables or herbs. So, but that this graft has been a bit of a game changer, and because it's got a lot of cambium contact both inside and outside on these grafts, and they're really easy to do. You can put as many as you can manage.
You definitely make them look easy, Craig.
Oh, well, it's practice, you know, but it is, they're a very simple thing to do, and I urge people to give it a go. I mean, it's been happening for a long time. It's not rocket science.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a case of lining up that little faint green line just inside the bark before the timber starts. If you get that lined up, you've got some pipework connected, and happy days, you'll get a graft that takes. You know, so
just to explain that to their listeners too, I mean, this is an upright stem, and Craig just slipped in, well, the old school about two and a half inches, little pieces of wood, and they're coming out from the main stem, and each of those is going to create a limb that will go horizontal, the fruit will set there.
Yeah, and one of those wonderful old things that I learnt from one of those old timers was, you know, if you can't put a graft in there, then you can activate a bud, and by doing a thing called notching, basically do is put a single cut above the bud, the width of the bud. And you slice a little bit of the bark out, make sure it's all the way back to the cambium. What you've actually done now is you've performed a notch.
Right.
Okay. So if you pruned that, that would activate that bud because you stopped the sap flow at the bud. You've got, that bud's now going to get oxygen.
Yeah, right.
And it's going to grow.
Yeah.
Okay. But I don't want I don't want to cut it off. I want this to become part of my framework branch.
Yeah.
So I can activate another one on the opposite side. And in the spring when the sap hits that, guess what's going to happen? The way they grow. The top bud will still get the oxygen as well, but because the sap flow stops there. So that's a really neat trick to learn. So,
How's he going there, Graham? This Craig, is he doing all right?
so, but the opposite is so because, you know, on the long wispy water shoot growth you get often on fruit trees, particularly pome fruits, so apples, pears, quince, and nashi, they fruit from fruit spurs. So. And I use, whenever I get that long, unwanted growth, I count up about four or five buds from the lateral branch where they start, and I actually undercut the bud above. So for instance, if I was looking, you know, this would be four or five buds, I'd actually undercut this bud, which is contrary to how you would normally...
Not quick enough.
Live right here, folks.
How you would ordinarily cut, because I'm now about an inch away from the last bud.
Yeah.
So the bud is not able to draw the sap up high enough, and this will cause dieback. And, of course, because the sap has flowed past the bud, it doesn't get the auxin.
Yeah, right.
This now gets florigen, that bud. Florigen is the enzyme that activates flower, and this will turn that bud into a fruit spur, as is evident of that undercut method, you
I've
see.
I've never heard that one before.
So
if you're able to just stick back for 10 minutes after the show, we might actually put some of this to, we might film some of this and get it to
because some of what I was filming before was the community events and things. So it'd be really good to have Craig actually saying
talking
what's
to
happening.
It, yeah, for sure. Yeah. That'd be wonderful.
But this is the little 1% gold that make the big difference on your fruit trees. And I've got trees that are top of door height, 16 years old, that I don't have to prune. In fact, I get sick of thinning the fruit. There's so much fruit on them because you get to actually incorporate fruit spurs wherever you want them. You know, and on espaliers, that's a really good thing to do because, you know, you've got a neat frame that's 3 metres high and fence height.
Yeah.
That you don't have to prune and it just sits there delivering
it's
fruit.
Framed,
I mean,
framed
it's
up
fantastic.
For you. Yeah, for sure. You know. Folks, you're listening to the 3CR Garden Show. Today on the panel we have Karen Sutherland, Craig Castry and Graham Morrison. If you've got any questions for Karen, Craig or Graham, call them in on 94190155. You can also text through a question or a comment to the 3CR text line, which is 0488 809 855. And we've actually had a couple of texts come in this morning already. There's a question for, it's just moved here. Question for Craig and Graham. What makes apples go mealy rather than crisp, as my variety should be?
Oh, okay. Well, there's a good chance I'd be checking my soil pH above you because there's probably a calcium problem.
So what when you refer to mealy, what does mealy refer to?
Flowery.
Okay.
Yeah.
So dry and powdery? Or?
Oh, well, yeah, it can be. I mean, it's probably not as moist as... So as the tree starts to build those secondary metabolites, to do all the things that fruit's got to have in it, juice, flavour, crispness, all that sort of stuff, structure... If the calcium is being locked up, then it's not available to the tree. So no good putting more calcium on it because if the pH is in an alkaline region, you can put a truckload of calcium on there and the tree's still not going to get it. Mm. So it's really trying to unlock the limiting factor. So I'll guarantee it's just about, it'll be compaction around the drip zone. I check the soil pH.
Okay.
You know, find out if it is alkaline, you get a heap of organic matter into it. Don't go putting sulphur on there to lower it.
No.
You know, the soil doesn't need any more sulphur.
Okay.
We've sadly joined the moron club. We keep continually applying more and more and more on soil. And, you know, you think about places like the Amazon rainforest, there's no one putting sulphur or lime on.
So if you're coming in, you do a pH test and it says you've got an alkaline soil, which is 8.5.
Yep. So I would aerate that soil with a garden fork. I'd stand on it, but not turn it over and give it a jiggle, pull it up.
Yep.
And I would dress it with some finished compost. And I say finished advisedly because a lot of people, you know, they should sift it so that it does separate what's finished from what's not. and I would apply an equal amount. If you've got the castings, worm castings would be an absolutely fantastic advantage in that mix. And then I would broadcast that over around the drip line of the tree and water it in well.
Okay.
And go back in about a couple of weeks' time. You'll find if you can get the soil back to functioning, microbes actually change soil pH.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
can
that's the reality.
Intercept, ask a question,
absolutely.
I'd have situations where, over the years, maintenance gardening, where the soil would suddenly turn into 8.5 because there were, and you'd look
there
around
was an
and
application
they'd,
of compost.
Yes, no, there'd be some concrete, it's concreting, and so
leaching,
the old
lime leaching.
Throwing stuff on. And so I used to use sulfur as an emergency to save the Daphne or whatever it was that really didn't like that. So would you, interestingly, because if I'd known that at the time, maybe I wouldn't have done it, would you still advocate your method, or would you say use some sulfur and then add the compost?
Sulfur's very slow acting, as you probably know. And
it took a while.
Yeah, it does. That's the thing. So I think that it's more about soil function. And remarkably, I mean, I didn't know this way back, but now I do. It makes sense. Microbes through biochemical signalling and plants are in constant contact. And if you think about a blueberry that needs an acidic range of 4.5, when they tested in the blueberry, food forest, not the blueberries we have today, but the derivative of, and they test that soil around the rhizosphere of the plant, it was down on 4.5, and yet they would check the soil around the root zone of another plant, not a metre away from it, it would be somewhere around about 6.5 or 7. And they go back to another blueberry and, 3 or 4 metres away and be back down in that range of 4.5. So what they've discovered is that the plants, when they use through photosynthesis, they're actually exudating the excess food that they make, and they're lacing this with flavonoids of sulfur, which attracts sulfur solubilising microbes to the root zone, lower the pH down to where they need it. And the minute that it's down where they need it, the plant stops lacing the exudates with the sulfur.
So you still stick with that when people have had sort of like a soil injury, you'd say, concrete application or someone rinsing their... It's not a very common thing, but if you do garden maintenance long enough, you come across it.
The concrete one is an interesting one because it's a constant source of...
Someone's rinsed it and they've just chucked it on. Yeah. So, I mean, you can scrape some of it off, but now I wish I'd could be bothered setting it up. It was a bit of a torture to a plant, though. Put two plants together, put the same amount of cement exudate on them, and then test the microbial remediation with the sulfur and see which works better.
Yeah,
and that's the reality. I think that you'll find that once you get and this is what we've lost the function of our soil. And it's really about getting the microbes and that microbiome of the soil back interacting with the plants as it's meant to do. And compaction is one of the biggest problems we have in Australia. They operate best at about 150 pounds per square inch. Now, atmospheric air also makes its way down at 150 pounds per square inch. You lose the air, you lose the function of the soil and the whole shooting mats. And to measure 150 pounds per square inch, I mean, I went out and bought a penetrometer, which is an expensive piece of equipment, I discovered.
A handy bit of kit, though.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely necessary for what I do. But it's an easy thing to do for the home gardener that doesn't have one. Use just hand pressure on your garden fork. And if it goes down easily into your soil, you've got nothing to worry about.
Yep.
But if you feel like you've got to draw your foot up to get some purchase into that soil, you have compaction above 150 PSI, which means you need to now stand on that fork and work backwards over your work. Do small areas and do as I suggest. Use that sifted finished compost. Get that organic matter back in there. Get cover on the soil. Soil should never, ever be uncovered because what grows there? Weeds.
Yeah.
Low succession plants back there trying to sort out the problem within soil. And it's funny, you get long, deep taprooted weeds. They are the succession plants for compaction.
Yeah.
And you won't, they'll continue to come back up through the seed bank, the weed seed bank. There'll be,
old weed seed bank.
Yeah,
one of the first things I learned as an apprentice.
To give you an idea, how powerful these things are, particularly when you've got good functioning soil, I looked at a study that was conducted on a farm that was surrounded by three others, hectare after hectare, and they had white clover literally covered on these three farms. And the one in the middle, and there were several hectares, I think from memory about 6 hectares, there wasn't an ounce of white clover anywhere to be seen. And they thought, well, how could that be? I mean, surely he has to have seeds of white clover on that farm. So they took away some soil samples and they sifted out the seed bank, they sifted out the soil and they put it through a digital seed sorter, and they found that his soil had over a kilo of white clover seed, and yet there was no white clover plants growing. Yet the other three farms were littered with it.
Yeah.
There was nothing else to look at but white clover. So they analysed the soil and, hey presto, there was the problem. His soil was spot on for nitrogen, theirs was lacking.
Yeah, right.
What's clover do? It's a nitrogen fixer. And, of course, they're drawing down their successional plants. They're drawing down atmospheric nitrogen, storing them in the nodules to bring back the nitrogen levels. That was not necessary on his farm because his nitrogen levels were spot on and they didn't germinate. So you may have weed seeds in your seed bank, but depending upon – and it's generally our management or mismanagement of soil as to what weeds are coming up, you know, so – if you overdo it with nitrogen, you'll get stinging nettles.
Yeah.
They're there to take them out. So it just goes to show you, you know.
We've got a message which has come in from Leah in Bagari in New South Wales, northern New South Wales. Welcome. Welcome, Leah. I'm planting a bare-rooted stone fruit this morning. I'll water in with 9:1 water season solution. When and how often do I water in between? So it's really about watering for a bare-rooted stone fruit, and how often. And so I'll throw that to Graham.
Yeah, okay. I think in our nursery days, we'd have deciduous plants in pots, and I used to go through the same thing. I was wondering, how does that really need a lot of water? And very little water, really, once the thing is there. I think, you know, you give the plant a good watering when you plant the thing.
Yeah.
And then I suppose you watch the weather a little bit, sort of thing. But usually another drink before it actually shoots out. Would you agree with that, Greg, about there?
Yeah.
So, Graham, best tips for establishing bare-rooted stock? You know, how would you go through that process? Could you describe what you would do?
Yeah, it depends on the variety of things these days, a bit sort of thing. Once upon a time, with apples, we'd chopped the top off them, and they'd spread out like a vase. Now we tend to let the central leader go up, and so you wouldn't chop the top off the thing. When they're dug out of the nursery, they're certainly the roots are cut back considerably, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So if they've cut back a third, you would cut the top of your newly planted plant by about a third.
To compensate for the losses, compost?
Yes, like Craig said, unbelievable. More and more, we're looking to build up the micro... The protozoa and
bacteria, fungi.
Yeah, and it's important. And with good composting, you start to develop that, and that's such an important thing.
Couldn't agree more.
Doncaster, it's a heavy soil out there.
It was strange. We only had about 8 inches of topsoil.
Right.
So the
trees, which is not unusual, yeah.
No, the trees never grew all that big, but they had good, I think because of the hardiness, the flavour in there was a lot better than, say, Bacchus Marsh, where they had a few metres of top soil sort of thing. And so that seemed to work well in that case. You had to watch the drainage.
Yeah.
A good clay, underneath sort of thing, an impervious clay. It meant that if you get too much water, particularly in the winter time, you would they would get too much water, like Craig was saying. The roots need oxygen. Yeah. If you haven't gotten any there, they'll die on you. And so, you know, in our lands there, we would mound up, which was a big. We grew tomatoes just as an example there. We had them on the fairly flat sort of soil one year, and we got a really wet winter. And it was not the winter, I'm just saying it's really when the tomatoes are growing that they got the real, the fruit trees suffered more in the winter time.
Yeah.
But because of that, after a while that we planted our crop, we had mounds on. In the nursery, I used to tell people that I'd say, you know, when you're buying a citrus tree there, put on a mound, you know, get above, so that when you get excess water there, it gets away.
Yep.
And then I go to their garden and they've got a mound, all right, but it's a pyramid sort of thing. you've got to dish the top, you know, to get the water in sort of thing if you put it up on a mound.
Yeah.
And I was wondering about that, just to break in a little bit, but if this person's in northern New South Wales, where are they? Are they in did she say Northern Rivers?
It was somewhere
we don't know. Okay, sure. We'd have to look it up. But if like what Graham was mentioning about the drainage, she might need to. If she, it depends whether she's near the coast or whether she's further inland where it's drier. To take account of the amount of rainfall she's got. And one other point that I didn't know whether she was asking about that was when you're planting a bare-rooted tree, you know, which all of us know, but maybe this caller doesn't. Plant your tree, put in the soil, and gently firm around the root ball to only half fill the hole, and then water it in. And, you know, to water in stages, and then backfill the rest of the soil.
Why do you do that?
To get rid of the air pockets. So I thought we might mention that because maybe that's what she was asking. I'm not sure.
Seaweed solution.
And definitely,
biostimulant. One of the other things too is that, you know, when you put a young formative tree in the ground, it's really important to stimulate growth. So you've got to prune. Because if you don't, this is the thing, people stand back in a nursery and they look at a beautiful, lovely shaped tree and think it's, you know, 5-6 foot tall. Oh,
I've
happy
just spent
days.
30
this is
bucks
be
on
great.
This and I'm going to chop
it
in
and
half.
And then they go and plonk it in the ground and don't prune it. And that's the worst thing they can do.
Because it's counterintuitive. You're pruning off some value or something.
Yeah, that's it. But the reality is that they really need to prune 2/3 of the tree off the top.
Which is pretty much what Graham was saying.
And what I tend to do, if it's an open vase or wine glass shape, prune out the centre and try and prune it back to 3 or 4 main framework branches, so a north, south, east and west, if you like. And generally at hip height is the first height at pruning.
Okay.
Prune to outward facing buds. And then in the following winter, regardless of how much growth that tree has put on, prune at chest height.
Okay.
And that's the last winter prune you should do.
Okay.
So no more winter pruning from them, because winter pruning encourages vigorous growth. Okay, so, and regardless of how much growth that puts on in that summer, is about 4 to 6 weeks after you pick the last bit of fruit is when you prune the first summer prune.
Could you just run that again? So,
hip height for first winter.
First winter.
Yep. Regardless of how much growth it puts on in the second year, at winter, chest height.
Yep.
And you want to reduce the lateral branches back closer to the framework branches, now those north, south, east and west.
Okay.
In that following summer is the first time it gets its first summer prune. And you want to prune that back down to about top of door height. Don't let them get any higher than that, because we've now got Queensland fruit fly.
Okay.
So you need to be able to easily manage net, pick, prune, thin, do all those things.
Yep.
You don't want to be doing off that lattice, you know. So,
sure.
So that's important. And if it's a peach or nectarine, the minute you pick the last piece of fruit, you need to prune to stimulate growth, because that's what produces your fruit wood in the coming spring.
Gotcha.
It doesn't fruit on second-year-old wood. It's only the new timber so if you're not using that energy that the tree puts on in that growth, you're going to miss out on the fruit. Prune in winter, you're going to prune the fruit wood off.
Yep.
Which is why I often get, my peach and nectarine only fruits every second year.
That's the end of
the pruners.
Yeah.
That's not the tree.
We've got a question here from Maggie from Drummond. Could you please talk about how to prune apples to slow down the overall growth? And does that still apply for apples and pears?
Yes, it does. Pears, all of the pome fruit. So again, I would about 4 to 6 weeks after you pick the last piece of fruit is when you want to prune.
But specifically to slow growth.
Okay, so prune above the buds to encourage fruit spurs, so that you don't because you stimulate growth when you prune against the bud. You deliver oxygen to that bud and away it grows, even if it's growth. So I prune my fruit trees during the course of the year. I am mindful, though, if I've got big bunches of fruits that are exposed to hot sun over the summer, sometimes rather than prune it, I'll break the branch so that the cambium layer is still in contact.
It doesn't look terribly good. Heresy.
Well, what happens is that it performs a veranda over the fruit and they don't get sun scorch.
That's a great idea.
But it stops it stops the growth.
Yeah, right.
And then when I've picked that last bit of fruit, then I prune it back accordingly and I've stopped the vigour and I've got the tree without the, you know, the fruit without the scorch.
Yeah.
So,
John, the other thing that comes into it, I advise people to go for a dwarf tree where possible.
Okay.
Craig might argue against that. Go down to Bulling Art and Garden, and they've got, I've counted that there's about 30 different varieties of fruit trees there they've got on dwarf stocks.
That's
sort
good.
Of thing.
That's good.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a... You don't want a whacking big tree for a home garden, you know. It's awkward. You get a ladder going, and you know, you don't want to fall off a ladder. And you know, comes to thinning the fruit out, which happens from time to time. You're pruning the tree. And certainly today with possums and fruit fly, you know, it becomes pretty well, you know, you must put a net over them to get the fruit crop.
Yeah, sure.
I was actually going to ask Craig. I was going to ask Craig when he was talking about the hip and the shoulder. Did that apply? This wasn't a gap. But does that apply to dwarf, or is that for semi-dwarf?
No.
So still the same height, even for dwarf trees.
So miniature peaches and nectarines.
Super dwarf.
I tend not to worry about pruning those at all. Like all fruit trees, dead, diseased, and damaged all year round. You know, if you see anything dead or diseased, take it off.
Build up branch structure. Correct. So that's a good point to make.
We pretty well use dwarfing rootstocks no matter where these days. I mean, and so particularly on the apples, we use MM102, which is about two thirds of a natural height tree. And they don't have a taproot, which is kind of good because that fibrous root growth is not invasive. It doesn't get into pipes or lift structures or paths and so forth, which I think sometimes stops particularly people that are living in much closer quarters like myself and you, Karen. You know, you're mindful of what trees you're putting in there for that very reason. But the dwarfing rootstocks today are fibrous roots and they're not invasive. So people need not worry about that, you know.
And it's the rootstock that has an effect on the overall size of the tree.
The rootstock controls the height that the tree grows at, and it's often picked for, you know, it might suit heavy clay. So, for instance, we've got MM102, which is a woolly aphis resistant rootstock for apple.
Okay. I'm guessing I do not have that one on one of my trees.
You'll notice that it's resistant, it says. It's not proof.
If only we knew these things 30 years ago, Craig.
Yeah. But of course, and of course, the other thing too is that they often suit particular soil types. There are some dwarfing rootstocks that need like M9s or M26. They're much, much smaller. They only grow to about 1.8 metres tall, but they need staking for their life.
Okay.
Whereas the MM102s, they don't, you know.
A bit more
and they're the robust ones that I tend to pick for a spadering.
Yeah.
So,
You listen to the 3CR Garden Show, joined today by Karen Sutherland, Craig Castry and Graham Morrison. Graham, you have some citrus. I just took a photograph, which I'll put on the socials. What do we have in front of us, Graham? There's something which is
like
coconut-sized.
Right. Probably put on my good son over in Denmark, came home for Christmas, and he said, this is a few years ago, he said, Dad, you've got a lot of edible plants here.
Yeah.
Why don't you count them up? So I had an infantry thing, a book, and I went through it, and some of them died. So but in vines, I didn't count herbs. I got a few herbs as well, but vines and fruit trees. What's the other one there? The vines. Berries was the other one. So berry plant. I came to 132 different varieties. So.
How spectacular.
Not the small stuff.
Not the small stuff. What is this? Sure, it looks like a lemon on steroids.
Yeah, that's sure. That's a citron.
A citron. Yeah. And okay.
Very thick skin to it. I think they commercially, they candy it.
It's for candy peel. Citrus peel's so good for you.
Yeah, is it really?
You scrape that. They've got generally quite a perfume in the citron.
We've all got a bit of citron peel off our thumbnail
you've
now.
You've already done it. Yeah,
I thought it was just a giant lemon, but it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And the oranges here, Graham?
There's three different varieties there. There's a Seville orange. There's a Washington navel, and that's a Leng navel. The Seville tends
to... Did you say Leng navel?
Yeah, L-E-L-E-N-G.
Leng.
Not a lot of people know about it, but it's really a little, in my book, it's a little bit sweeter than a Washington navel even. I had a knife and a thing...
Craig's got lots of hardware.
I'll try and chop them in half and give you a taste of that.
That'd be great.
But then the other ones I've got here, just John, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
I've got kumquats, and there's round one that we usually see around the place, similar to the one on the top there. That's a marumi. And then there's the Nagami.
Oh, yes, please.
Nagami.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Straight into the... As well. Yeah, she knows all about Nagamis.
Nagami's the long one, particularly. Yum. Pop the whole thing in your mouth and it as well.
Mm. Okay. It's so tasty.
Yeah. Now, I think this one is a variegated marumi.
Okay.
And I've got a lovely bush of this. And so often a variegation in your other green plants and stuff, it looks great, you know. It just adds to the aesthetic appeal, I suppose, of your landscape. Then you come into, I didn't bring a Tahitian lime. But I've got a Kaffir lime.
Yeah.
And that's an Australian lime. The Kaffir lime, again, you probably get a bit of a smell on that one, John, just to try that one.
Terrific.
Thank you. The Kaffir lime, they use the peel in Thai cooking. Yep. Yeah, sure.
Graham, is the Australian lime a bush lime or is it... what is it exactly?
Small tree.
But is it what you call... That's what I forgot to bring in, a bush lemon that I got from someone's farm in New South Wales. Yeah. You know, the ones that just grow wild? Sure. Yeah, right. Oh, my God. The flavour.
Yeah. And there again...
Small tree.
Here I've got the finger lime. They also so call it caviar lime. Thank you. Because the little inside there's a little fruit sacks. Yeah. They're round and they look a little bit like the caviar from the sturgeon. Is it the eggs I'm trying to say.
And that's a little native citrus.
No. There's quite a variety of those now.
Yeah.
Today...
That's the nicest one.
Yeah, it is the nicest one. Original and the best, I think.
It's
red centre lime or something. Yeah, it's the most beautiful.
They're prickly little suckers.
It was funny.
I grew one of those a few years ago now and... I'd forgotten about where I put it, you know, and I just, you get busy and I went down, I thought, oh, look at that, that's all full of fruit. So, of course, I stuck my hand in it.
Bang.
Hey, well, I never did that again. Ouch. Wow.
I did the same yesterday, actually.
We learned,
I checked the hand very quickly and went and tended the wounds.
Folks, you're listening to the 3CR Garden Show, joined today, my name's John Arnott, joined today by Karen Sutherland, Craig Castry, Graham Morrison. If you wanted to call in with a question to the panel, call us on 94190155 and you can text a question through on 0488809855. And we've got a couple of text messages which have come up here. Carlos, tall Carlos from Croydon, has a question about the best time to cut back a lemandra, with the consideration that lemandras are larval food plants for native butterflies.
Yes.
So any thoughts on cutting back lemandras?
Would you mean, does he mean cut it back completely to refresh it?
To refresh it, yeah.
As in what I would say councils do.
Yeah. So, you know, it's got big, it's got too big, it's maybe, it needs to be cut
down. I've got a big one near a, it grew much bigger than I expected, near a pass, so it gets its side bits cut all the time. But mine's not flowering at the moment. I'm pretty sure they flower in spring.
Yeah.
So that would just be cutting it, cutting it back now.
Yeah. Yep.
But bear in mind, because it's a monocot, it's a monocot or a grass, don't just, you're going to trim it all. Yeah, if you're going to trim it back, you need to cut it back not too low, maybe a foot or, 30 centimetres high, so that you don't cut it back too far. But, and it's a good chance to clean up a bit of stuff inside it that way, but then it will completely sprout again.
And quite quickly.
A year,
I think the question was around, because it's a larval food plant for skippers.
Oh, because it's going to flower in spring. So maybe
I think it's actually about the caterpillars. So you'd be chopping off the host plant, effectively.
Oh, right. So I'm not getting you there.
Any
I haven't had any on mine.
Well, I think the trick would be, if you've got more than one,
cut back one
and move the prunes.
I was purely thinking of, you've got to cut it back and regenerate it. So not to do with the flowers, to do with the leaves.
So ideally you've got a couple, and if you don't, maybe plant a couple if it's about providing habitat for local wildlife.
Yeah.
And then take the prunings and just leave it at the base. The caterpillars will soon move off. You know, Karen and I, with the butterfly house at the zoo, did you ever do butterfly house?
Though?
They're very mobile. Caterpillars are very mobile things, and if their food source dries up, effectively, they'll move to the next.
Or to the next plant.
So maybe leave the prunings in and around the base of of another one, and don't cut them all down at once. Might be the advice.
That definitely would be.
Yeah.
I think you should. You're answering that one, John. Misunderstanding.
We've got a caller, not a caller. We've got someone texted in from Peak Hill in New South Wales. Quite a few New South Wales listeners this morning, which is terrific. Want to grow strawberries productively in Peak Hill, New South Wales. What soil type, pH, and sun exposure to provide for great yields?
Full sun, I'd say, first of all.
Full sun. The caller has a raised garden beds in a very large area. Room for a few more raised garden beds.
They're out between Parks and Dubbo.
Parks and Dubbo. Okay.
Fairly cold.
So tips and tricks for effective strawberry growing for our listeners.
One of the things that I grow strawberries underneath are fruit trees. They're a fantastic ground cover. And, of course, there's a symbiotic relationship between plants, living plant roots and fruit tree roots.
Yeah, okay.
So, but the key is don't leave them there a second year. Pull them up and thin them down because become matted and unproductive.
Okay.
So it's a bit of maintenance scenario on when you put strawberries in the ground, I believe.
Yeah.
So,
I do a different system altogether.
Okay.
I give people either a three bed system when I'm doing garden plans. So you plant your strawberries in the, because they're expensive to buy and you've got to replace them every 3 years. And a relative in Switzerland showed me this. You plant them and then you take the runners off. And you put them into the second bed, the runners.
Yeah.
So you've got, then year two, you've got
succession.
Yeah, it's a succession planning of three beds, and you need about 12 plants per person. That's another thing that people often forget. Otherwise, you won't get enough fruit. That was a common question, why don't I have enough strawberries? And they'd have one plant, you can't expect to get enough fruit without 12 per person. And so then you put the runners into the second bed. So the next year, you've got the plant, first bed producing well, second bed establishing. Take the runners off bed two and bed one, put them into bed three. And so as you move around, then by the time you get back to the beginning, you can take them out of, by the time you get to year three, you've the first bed's dying off and,
you have all age classes.
Yeah. And the other thing I like doing is, and which requires frequent changes, is I like growing them in wall gardens because more space and they're away from all the slugs and snails.
Yeah, yeah.
So again, a walled garden.
Wall gardens, like little planter beds hung up on a wall.
Okay.
To get more into the space and also, to grow more things, to find more space.
Containerised?
Containerised, yeah. So little so
I have,
rectangular beds hung up.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I have half pots on my fence.
That kind of thing. The same thing.
So I actually strategically place them one underneath another, and I've got a 12 mil drip pipe across the top.
Okay.
With a dribbler into the top pot, and they get 30 minutes of water over the summer months. Per day, and of course they just fill up the top pot and they drain down into the bottom and so on. So yes, it's
you're always irrigation. I'm an irrigation person too. They need water.
They need constant moisture.
I used to grow them on foam fruit boxes on the top of my garage roof.
Yep.
And I had to have them on set to come on four times a day on the 40 degree days.
Yeah, okay. Otherwise you would lose
they
your
would just
fruit.
Dry
they'd
out.
Shrivel
and,
up, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Look at the commercial strawberry plantations. Very, very neat, you know, they're all mounded rows. They've got plastic over the top and probably an irrigation system underneath the plastic. And the other thing I was thinking of, if you're growing commercially, you probably go for one of these big, large, the thing that people love in the supermarkets. Otherwise, there's some good strawberry varieties, like I think... Tioga used to be one that I like better than Red Gauntlet. It was a big glamorous looking thing that didn't taste so well.
Yeah, I can't say.
Tioga's probably one of the better ones.
Yeah.
Well, I got one. My mum and dad used to go down to a Red Hill U-Pick strawberry farm and they had one called Majestic. But of course, it was under PBR. But anyway, one of my nieces was down there a few years ago. And she rang me and said, "Hey, Uncle Craig, guess what they've got for sale down here? I'm at the U-Pick strawberry farm." I thought, "Let me get strawberries." She said, "No strawberry plants." I said, "You're kidding."
There you go.
She said, "No, they've got Majestics." I said, "Get as many as you can. I'll fix you up when you get back." So I've now got Majestic plants.
Very good.
Me tell you, they are awesome. Yeah. I've never tasted a strawberry like
when are you
like
selling
it.
Those, mail order, Craig?
yeah, fantastic.
It's different. The public don't get a strawberry or a peach that is really, enjoyable.
Yeah.
We have a question here, no name, no location, but what you look for in a good soil. So you're purchasing a soil to do a gardening project. What are some of the considerations when purchasing soil?
Can I say first of all, and refer to Bulleen Nursery, Bulleen Art and Garden Centre? They're the only, and anyone's free to ring in and contradict me, but they're the only nursery I know that test their soil for contaminants.
Okay.
And that's become a thing in all sorts of places where herbicides have entered the landscape system, and so they've caused mutations to happen in vegetables.
Through curbside recycling.
Sometimes it's golf courses, I think, various places.
Yeah.
There can be different ways. Maybe a herbicide sprayed on a paddock and then cows eat it. That manure or that straw is cut. And, that can be different ways where it gets into the system. And then you get if it's mutating, it only mutates some vegetables, like tomatoes get quite mutated.
Okay.
And so then you can't really safely eat those fruit from those plants. So, that's been it's not everywhere, but it has happened.
So Bulleen Art and Garden, they'll test this all.
They do test this all for contaminants.
In parts per million type of thing?
It's a long time since I looked it up, but you can go and talk to Alistair. I'm sure he'd love me mentioning his name.
Sure.
Howdy, Karen.
But, terrific. Aside from that, the physical properties are very well thought through as well.
So they test the pH. And actually, that's another funny thing. When you mentioned pH of 8, there was a funny situation that happened, and Craig mentioned, compost being completely broken down. And there's a weird thing that happens if you do have to bring in soil. There's a weird thing that you can test the soil with a blue liquid white powder type of pH tester and get a false alkaline reading, and that is when that can happen when the organic matter is not 100% broken down. So it's actually
it's a compost,
neutral,
which is,
but it's just some of the components are not 100% broken down, and that was a thing that was happening at Bulleen years ago. And different people were testing the soil and going back to the yard and saying, "Well, what's going on? It says it's 8, but and that was something that was found out, that those tests give a false reading when you've got, so that could happen. But make sure your nursery or your yard test their soil and ask them what the components are.
Yeah.
you know, what are they putting in there?
And it does want to have some organic matter in it. Yep. You know, it needs to be a bit of a mix. You know, I see these garden blend mixes, and you're right. I mean, I take along, and I take just a moisture, a combined moisture meter pH test kit. I mean, it sends the alarm signals generally. Yeah, I mean, and then then I get out my proper test kit and do it.
Because you're getting alkaline.
Yeah, alkalines. The minute it starts to show me an alkaline reading, now it warrants a further test.
Further inspection, yeah.
Yeah.
But so, pick it up in your hands, smell. The old way we used to look at soil without testing.
Good.
Yeah, it should smell good.
Yeah.
What's it got in it? Does it feel nice?
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of potting mixes are not good.
And it should hold
anymore.
Together a reasonable clump, and when you touch it, it should break apart again.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you sort of want a good tilth in the soil, which, you know, so it's all of those
indicating organic
things.
Matter.
Yeah. Yes, exactly, I mean, it's the wonderful thing about organic matter is that it builds humus, and I suspect that in modern soils today available in sand soil yards, they lack a fair bit of humus. Humus comes from, obviously, decomposed organic matter, and, of course, it means that it's microbially rich.
Yeah.
You know, and there's earthworms generally involved in that. Well, I don't think I've ever seen earthworms in any garden soil ever that I've purchased. You know, so that's something that's going to come from your own garden. You're not going to be able to buy soil that's got that stuff in it. And if you could, you wouldn't be able to afford it in the first place. You know,
there's some pretty terrible soil mixes out there, I have to say.
Yeah, there is. So I think you've got to be fairly careful.
Another one that I've been caught out by is weed seeds. In a brand new or couch pieces one I put in somewhere up in Country Victoria, it ended up with about, I think, nearly 20 different weed species group. I was extremely disappointed.
Yeah.
Problem is that some of the organic matter that they use in amongst some of these seed mixes can be things like lucerne, and they're getting first cut, which is cheap, because guess where the weed seed is?
In
the first cut, because it competes with the heads of the lucerne. So, of course, they take the first cut, cheap, put it into the compost that they're making, and, of course, you get all the weed seeds with it. You know, so that's another one. So when I say to people, when are you going to go out and buy some of this stuff for yourself, make sure you're asking, is it first cut or second cut? Get the second cut stuff.
Yep.
Don't touch the first cut stuff.
Yep.
So.
What about sand?
It should have a degree of washed sand in it as well. You know, there's no two ways about that. But
Or sandy loam, as we call it. There's a lot of that used in the projects at the Melbourne Zoo.
Years gone by, we used to get a 50-50 mix of sandy loam and mountain soil.
Yeah, that's right.
You
know,
but you can't get that.
On mountains, you don't get mountain loam
and
the Dandenongs.
The sandy loam used to have bracken fern in it. Bracken fern root. You know, that's a long time ago.
That is a long time ago, So, look, it's a little tricky. I mean, ask for specifications for the soil.
Yeah.
Would you suggest taking a water bottle and wetting some soil up and trying to roll it and see if it'll...
Good idea. I mean, look, there's all sorts of tests that I like to do with it. I mean, I'd also like to do some sort of a dispersion test just to see whether it is dispersive, because if it forms cloudy, and you can't, and it doesn't settle, I mean, you're likely to lose a lot of that in the rain. It's going to run off your land, you know, so it's not terribly good soil.
And also ask, because we don't know where the caller is from, ask the neighbours where they get their soil from.
That's another good idea.
Go for local knowledge.
Excellent. Well, soils ain't soils.
I've got a T-shirt.
Did I see you were doing a soils, the Foundations of Soil workshop recently?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yep. Soil masterclass. So healthy soil equals healthy plants equals healthy people.
Okay. Is that material available on a website,
if you go to my website, I do a daily post, and there's a lot of past posts there that have that available. Of course, there's also my book.
And your website is?
CraigCastry.com.au.
Okay.
So soil is not a dirty word, is there available. So that's my latest book.
Yeah, for sure.
So, and that's really on how to navigate forward differently than we have.
Yeah.
Get out of the moron club.
Mm.
Yeah, which is something that we sort of we need to do.
So, well, it's kind of getting back to the fundamentals and the basics, isn't it?
We've got to get back to growing stuff with biology, and that's the problem. We've disconnected the biology from our soil, which has disconnected the plants that we grow in it, and it's disconnected our gut microbiome from it as well. And it's one of the reasons why we've got the health problems in the community that we have today. We're just simply not getting the nutrition that we were meant to get. There's some suggestion that we're operating off about 8% of our DNA. 92% of it switched off. They used to call it junk DNA, but they know that that's now not the case. And a lot of this biology, and particularly we mentioned glyphosate, that shuts down the shikimate pathway within a plant that builds those 9 essential amino acids that we depend on for good health.
Yeah, right.
And when you get glyphosate involved in this, that shuts them down, and we don't get those essential amino acids which form the building blocks of good health. So, you know, that's the sad part of that. So I think if you can grow more of your own food at home where you live, I'd be doing that if I possibly could.
Craig, you mentioned earlier 120 square metres. What difference does that make? We had a conversation at the 3CR celebration. And you've been aggregating the 120 square metre blocks. Could you talk to that?
Look, through my daily posts and the presentations and so forth that I do, and the education that I do, it's a busy life. There's no two ways about that. And I generally debrief the day, and I sort of think, okay, where am I at? What did I get done? What have I still yet to do? What am I going to post about tomorrow? And I sort of started looking around the garden, and I thought, 120 square metres, am I fooling myself? What real difference am I actually making? I mean, it's not a lot of land in the scheme of things. I sort of felt a bit flat this particular day, and I thought, but on the other hand, I am encouraging others to join this journey, join the revolution, so to speak. So I thought, wouldn't it be fantastic if I could find some way of being able to quantify what influence that is actually having, so that people can feel a part of something that's a bit bigger than themselves, you know? I'm sure that we're making some difference. Anyway, I had the brainwave of putting together a document that encourages people that feel inspired after a presentation or any contact with what I'm doing. If they're feeling like they want to change, put down their postcode and the amount of square metres that they're in charge of. They're the steward of
the curating.
Yes, that they're actually, you know, affecting change on.
Yep.
And I'm happy to report at the moment we're up to 81,500 acres. And that's 19 weeks ago. That has blown me away. Now, I've got a page full of it's one line short, and once it gets that I'll enter it. Now, I've already had a look, and there's a couple of 200 or 300 acres that of farmers that were up in Forbes that had come along to my event, so that they've put down there. So make no bones about the fact that whether it's just 2 square metres that you're making a difference on, this all matters. We can. I'm just sick and hear about, you know, net zero this, net zero that, and I hear a lot of talk, but if we want change, we need to be the change. It's heartwarming and inspiring to see just how many people that are starting to march this way and make this change.
It totally makes a difference.
It does.
I mean, when you understand that when we turn soil over, we liberate the carbon. I mean, it's a heavy molecule, carbon, and we get 2 oxygen molecules attached to it like a magnet. It becomes CO2, and up it goes in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And with that, we lose carbon water-holding capacity in our soil. And if you think about how we've been producing our food, ploughed and fields that are left fallow for 6 months sometimes, we lose the evaporation, the water, and we lose the carbon with it. And I've got an overhead satellite graph that shows Western Australia separating agricultural land, 13.5 million acres separated by the rabbit-proof fence. And all of the cloud formation is down where the scrubland is. The thing is with this that we've missed the point of, that plants release, and so do the microbes, a bacterial called an aerosol, which forms the nucleus upon which water vapour forms, and that becomes cloud formation. So it's bare over these 13.5 million acres, and over the scrubland side, you can see where the cloud formation is, where the aerosols are.
Charlie Massey kind of talks about this a little bit
It gets 40% less rainfall on the agricultural side of the land than it does on the scrubland side. So
cause and effect.
Absolutely, and this is why I'm saying that, you know, full gardens grow no weeds. And if you we're expected to look after gardens where we live, we pay a fortune for where we live, whether you're renting or you're purchasing.
Yeah.
Fill your gardens up with something you can put on the plate.
Well, David from Upway has texted in just asking a question of the panel for some good potted plants, so plants in containers, to be planted or located under a southwest-facing veranda.
Oh, well, is that an opportunity for me,
excuse me, everybody,
to drop in that there's a lovely article about myrtles in this month's Organic Gardener.
So, and Karen, who wrote that
Shameless self-promotion.
Who wrote that article?
I don't know. Oh, look, it's Karen Sutherland. They like a bit of veranda time. Yep. They can be out in the garden as well in some shade. Mm-hmm. And I know you said southwest, but it's only going to be, I'm guessing that it's only in the really harsh heat of summer that you're going to get
direct light.
Get the really direct light. And you've got a lot of myrtles to choose from. You've got lemon, aniseed, cinnamon. There's a couple of other more unusual ones as well. But those ones are really useful. They're fantastic for tea to help repair the damage from all the things we survive on in this world. So, yeah they've got many. It's funny, they're described, their health properties are described as anti, as in antimicrobial, antifungal, blah, 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 anti-inflammatory. Yeah. Yeah. But really, they're pro, you know, they boost your health. So they're fantastic. I mean, I drink lemon, there's lemon myrtle in my little takeaway teacup there with my morning black tea. They're fantastic plants. By keeping them in pots, you keep them smaller, you keep them away from frost because none of those three like frost, although cinnamon's a bit more hardy. So they're a lovely plant to consider. Many uses.
So the lemon myrtle that people have in their garden, how do you go about making a lemon myrtle tea? Is it just pluck a leaf off?
Very
easy. A couple
of
leaves off?
Yeah.
What's your go-to?
One nice big leaf and you crush it up and you get to smell it, so you get your aromatherapy at the same time. Then you plonk it in the cup and you add boiling water. But it's best one leaf? Yeah, one big leaf.
One big leaf.
And when they grow in more shade, like on a veranda, you'll get bigger leaves. Mm. So, you know, because they're growing bigger to attract more light for photosynthesis. Yeah. But it's better if you pop a saucer or a little plate over the top, because as they're infusing, you lose some of those valuable oils.
Right,
okay. So the best technique is to cover them.
Hold it in.
Yeah, hold it in for 3 or so minutes.
Yep.
And if you've got good quality leaves as opposed to something you buy generally, your fresh leaves, like all your fresh herbs in your garden, are so much stronger. So you can usually reinfuse your lemon myrtle leaves a couple of times, two or three times.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can get another couple of goes out of them.
Okay.
And also, if you're making a teapot, you just put, 3 or 4 or 5 leaves in. So, So lemon myrtle's very uplifting. It's good for coughs and colds, sore throats, that sort of thing. Cinnamon myrtle's a bit more balancing. It doesn't have a very strong flavour, but it's, you know, I think it's quite good for blood sugar and a balancing effect.
Okay.
And aniseed myrtle, you can just use, and you can use lemon myrtle anywhere you'd use lemongrass, which is so much harder to grow in many parts of Victoria.
Okay.
So it's got a spicy gingeriness to it.
Yeah,
and then aniseed myrtle, you can use anywhere you'd use fennel or any of those anise flavoured herbs.
Great. Graeme, any tips for potted stock on under southwestern eaves?
You know, if they're in pots, I've got about 10 pots in my garden, some ceramic and some plastic, but the pots are all different varieties of herbs. So I go out and I graze, you know, a little bit of that one. I don't know. It's probably not right, Craig, but when I had the nursery, and probably in my horticulture career, I always think that, you know, some people, they go for, say, dynamic lift. You've got to fertilise that. What you put that, put it all the time. But we tend to advise people to try chicken manure. Okay, that's dynamic lifter. Cow manure, some sheep manure, aquasols, some thrive. You know, there's a whole lot of different things there. And my theory was, what you miss out on the merry-go-round, you pick up on the hoopla sort of thing. And, and the same with me with my diet. You know, I tend
to. Well, that's too true. Yeah, we've lost a lot of diversity, Graham. So I couldn't agree more.
Okay, thanks, mate.
And Graham, I was just doing a little bit of research before the show. You are an author. You wrote a memoir.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I wrote a book in my retirement called The Stairway to Me. It was sort of quite a bit about the old days in Doncaster. You know, people take it for granted now, and they just, it's rather interesting to see what actually happened there.
Yeah.
You know, quite a few thousand acres of fruit trees.
Yeah.
And the community, you'd see a car or a horse-drawn vehicle go up the road, and you'd know who it was. You know, we knew everybody in the district.
Doncaster was a village.
Yeah, that's so much so. We had three balls where we would go and dance until 3 o'clock until the thing. You know, everybody was well known and respected. I don't think we locked our doors, you know, in those days, sort of thing, which you tend to trust people around the place more than you possibly can now.
Yeah.
So, enjoyed getting it together. I'm a bowler now. I play lawn bowls. So
I did note that. Yes.
Yeah, I took my book up there and I'd got it published and I had 124 booklets, and some of the money went to the bowling green. But the secretary, oh, a great book, and he sort of gave it a good spiel for everybody, so I sold the whole lot, you know.
Well done.
So are you out of print? Is it possible for people to grab copies of your book?
I think not. I've only got about four left.
Okay.
Hoping I'll get another grandchild, and I'll give them one.
Good for you. Yeah. And Morrison's Nursery, did it have a particular focus on fruit trees, or is it a more general nursery?
Very, very much so.
Right.
I think probably pears and apples were probably the most popular fruit tree grown. We concentrated in peach trees.
Peach trees.
Dessert peach trees rather than the Goulburn Valley clingstone stuff. Dad would, you have a tree just coming into ripeness, and he taught us, well, you would be able to pick that peach that was ripe tomorrow, sort of thing. There's a little bit of the texture of the skin, how tight the fruit was, and how much the non-redded part that became a nice. It was a glowing, there's a little bit of pink in the, I suppose it was beige coloured sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so we would actually go around the tree up to seven times for picking the crop sort of thing. And that was, we were able to give the fruiterers, which is, like our nurseries, many fruiterers around the place in those days. We give that peach to people where they're not used to that care. We worked up a very 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 good trade, I think. Yeah.
It's quite extraordinary. I mean, you must reflect on those days as kind of the halcyon days.
Yeah, sure. They were good days, that's for sure. Worked very hard, you know.
Yeah.
You tell just a story. We had about three people working for us at this time, and if you get out early in the morning, it was about 5 o'clock, so that you'd pick the fruit. Not a good time of the day. But you'd pick the fruit cool and just stack it in the boxes to stay cool rather than show the bruises if it got warm. And mum would come down with some tea and some biscuits for us. About what a great mother I had. That would be about 8 o'clock, and old Billy the horse is in the showers with the carpet, and we're filling our boxes and putting him in the trays, and always that there was sandwich left for Billy, sort of thing, you know, the horse. This day. We must have been hungry, and one of the workers said, "You've eaten all the sandwiches. Billy hasn't got a sandwich." So they went on the smart cook. He said, "Why don't you give him a cup of tea?" So without a word of a lie, my mum said, she took it up to him, and his big lips, you know, didn't spill a drop. It all went down. So.
The voice you're listening to is Graham Morrison, a stalwart of the 3CR Gardening Show. Been on the show for possibly 30 years.
Yeah, thank you.
It is absolutely wonderful having you in the studio this morning. Karen, you've been on the road. You've been on a road trip.
I have.
What you been doing?
We trekked up the coast to Hervey Bay and then down through the middle, through Orange and through where some of these people have been calling from today. So, I saw a lot of different things.
And you brought in some wares?
Some bush orange, Caparis Mitchellii, I'm pretty sure which species it is, and that I managed to see.
Which is a native caper.
Yes, but called bush orange because when it's ripe, which these are not because it's not late enough in the season, but these have been chewed on by something and people here were speculating maybe emus because they're pretty hard fruit. Mm-hmm. And they look like a pomegranate inside, the seeds, and so that's one of their other common names is native pomegranate. But apparently when they're ripe, and you have seen them, John, that when you bust them open, they taste like oranges, and they are dark, like a really bright orange, and smell amazing.
Incredibly, and smell incredible. Probably smell better than they taste.
So I keep smelling these, wishing that they would smell, but they don't have any smell.
So have you grown any native capers in your garden to date?
No. I've just found these fruits. So we've been talking about them in the group I'm in, Indigenous study group I'm in, where we study medicine and
culture.
Could
you tell us about your Indigenous study group? It's quite remarkable.
We've been together about, I think this might be our 8th or 9th year
it's
together.
Women's business?
It's women, totally women, yeah. It's a Wiradjuri woman teaches us. So she's from Kondo. Min Maya is her name. Hello, Min Maya. She'll be listening, or she'll, you know, her ears will be burning. What's she saying about me? And it's shrunk down over the years for various reasons, and so there's probably about 20 or 24 of us now.
Okay.
So, we've been learning. A lot of the plants we learn about are Wiradjuri, so hence why we're interested in. I was so excited to find the bush orange because we've heard about it for years from her.
Sure.
And because she lives near the coast now, around inland from Maruya, which is south of Batemans Bay, so therefore
she's not on country.
No, but she's incorporated a lot of plant. There's a lot of plants we use from the Jura River Valley.
Sure.
Which interestingly is the valley where Jackie French lives too.
Sure.
So which I visited years ago too. So we use cinnamon myrtle grows there, and lemon, all sorts
probably.
Of real. Sorry.
Lemon myrtle probably.
No, it doesn't actually. But there's a lot of cinnamons and. There's kangaroo apples that grow wild there, and there's all sorts of things. All so we things, used things from there as well. So
Well, it sounds like a terrific trip.
The trip is great. We mostly visited. It was my husband and the poodle, so they got brought along to visit people, plant nerds basically. So we did visit some of his friends, but it's all the women in my group. So, they sort of are scattered from lower New South Wales up to Queensland. So, went visiting and looked at their properties. Some of them have properties that are, one woman's got 40 acres cleared and 100 acres of bush, which she couldn't find the ecologist report. I'm really wanting to see that. She's had ecologists go through who are apparently super excited. So a Newey Creek, someone inland from. Yeah, apparently there's rare things there. I saw rose myrtles there. They're not Backhausias, but she's got those growing. Mm. We were cruising around in the Polaris type machine.
Yeah.
And I'd go, oh, stop, look. And there'd be a little rose myrtle, this tiny little delicate plant growing amongst this thick bush.
Yeah, sure.
So, amazing. So she's got, and it's koala habitat. We'd stop and look at all the koala scratches on the trees.
Yeah.
And, so they're in there somewhere.
Yeah, lovely.
So, we saw all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And you've brought in some some bits and bobs.
Lemon myrtle to give to people that I've foraged from somewhere, and some choco plants because they're shooting now. And that's another one that I picked them all before I've left Victoria because I thought, oh, the rats will get them. Otherwise, possums don't tend to eat them, the rats do. But it's, you know, they were starting to shoot ages ago, and so the season of chocos has shrunken because of the changes to the climate that we're experiencing. So that's a bit annoying. Mm. You've got to eat them quicker. But yeah, it's time to plant them. Well, if you do plant them now because it is still cold, probably put a tree guard around them, a plastic tree guard to protect them, to keep them a bit warmer till they get going.
Okay. Okay. Mm. Yeah, terrific. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Craig, we were talking about the foundation of the landscape is soil. Soil biota, is that your measure of
soil microbiology, I guess. Fungi and all that lives within that thin veil of what we stand. We know more about what we see in the space than we do about what we stand on, which is kind of a problem. And, it's sent me down a rabbit hole now 5 years, and I don't see another time out of that rabbit hole. I'll continue because it's changing. It's there's so much more research being conducted into it, and it's changing weekly. We're finding out so much more that we just didn't know. We're now understanding the relationship between the microbes on just a single seed. Mm. It can be up to 8 billion microbes on a seed, on the inside of the seed coat, around the outside of the seed coat, on the embryo, and of course the importance of getting that connected with the biota in the soil as fast as you possibly can, because the two form a relationship. One feeds the other. The microbes solubilise the minerals and the plants nutrients that they can't get or reach, and the plant in excess through photosynthetic sugars feeds the microbes in return through that biochemical signalling. Plants know what they need in the amounts they need it, when they need it, and we get that wrong.
The biggest mistake people make with soils to disrupt those natural
systems? Turning soil over, I guess, and forgetting about diversity. You know, putting things in rows is probably about the worst thing we can do. Keeping soil covered, getting four or more plant family groups together is a big thing, keeping soil covered, and aeration. Get the air back in the soil.
Get the air back in the soil.
It's most important. I mean, nothing good happens above or below soil without air. Try and hold your breath for 3 or 4 minutes and see how you go.
Yeah, sure.
And it's no different down there. I mean, they don't function. If they can't get the air, you lose the air, you lose the water, and then it goes south from there.
Karen, your garden loosely structured?
Loosely structured, yeah. It's been just putting, okay, there's a spot, yeah, I'll put that in there.
Yeah, yeah. So it's
if that's what you mean.
Yeah.
There's some shapes that originally started out years ago. So the garden, you know, there's certain garden bed shapes and things like that.
I had one thing to say to those lovely people out there. I've been trying different plants over my life. Just fairly recently got into putting tamarillos in.
Tamarillos.
Around our Doncaster area, they grow so well. Once upon a time, frost would knock them around. You don't get the severity of the frost now. But there's some lovely things there. Cut them in half, spoon the flesh out. Go for it.
That's the biggest tamarillo I've ever seen in his hand.
It's a solid tamarillo. Yeah, yeah. We just have a couple of text messages which have come in, more comments and questions. Rosie from Mitcham, great to have a second Karanga. So out in Warrandyte, where Beasley's Nursery is now Karanga.
Oh.
So it's the second. So thanks, Rosie, for mentioning from that. Mm-hmm. And Wendy from Wani. I wonder what Wani is.
Could be Wandilagong.
Loves the new Garden Show merch. So I think Wendy's jumped on the site and had a look at the T-shirts. And I should have mentioned earlier that the T-shirt designs were done by Tim Ubergang from the Royal Botanic Gardens, Melbourne, and formerly of Melbourne University. Tim's a very clever graphic designer. The term which is used on all the merch is zygomorphic radio. Yeah, so it's really good. So I could see, Craig, next time you come into the studio, you'll get one of those. Folks, you've been listening to the 3CR Gardening Show this morning. We do need to start winding the show up. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Hope today has been interesting and informative. I'd love to thank our panellists, our three panellists for this morning. Karen Sutherland from Edible Eden Design. Thanks so much, Karen, for coming in. Lovely to have you in. Craig Castry from...
Well, I'm an independent educator, mate. I mean, you know, Edible Gardens by Craig Castry.
Edible Gardens
by... You'll find me.
Yeah, good one. Yeah. So jump on Craig's website to find out some more. And it's just been so lovely to have Graham Morrison in the studio again, Graham.
Thank you.
Lovely to hear your voice. Thanks for coming in. Big thanks to Matt and Di for coming in this morning doing the producing. Next week's show, we've got Stephen Wells coming in. So Stephen will be at the helm. Stick around for alternative news and enjoy your garden. Cheers for now, folks.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.